Hello everyone and welcome back to the Esports Roundtable podcast, where we discuss the past, present and future of all things business and esports. I'm your host, Joe Hills from Infinite Esports and Entertainment, and for this episode we will be diving into the wonderful world of esports legality. We'll be exploring player contracts, how easy it is to move, you know, these international esports athletes all over the world, and also how these players are represented, as well as diving into a little bit more detail on the protection of IP and, you know, how the legal process is built up around actually, you know, establishing the next esports titles or ecosystems. To take us through this, the man himself, Bryce Blum, will be stepping onto the show to really share his story and his insights on this area. Bryce is one of the legal authorities in this industry, working across all of the major tier one esports titles, as well as being on a retainer for multiple publishers and team organizations as well. So we'll be bringing Bryce on the show in the next few minutes. One of the things I just wanted to express to all you guys is that obviously we've gone through a huge rebranding process to really take the Esports Roundtable up another level. That went live last week with our episode with Nielsen and FanAI, where we were spotlighting the Overwatch League Season 1 and the overall state of esports analytics. So if you missed that one, head back that way and listen to those two thought leaders really break down how the industry has evolved and how every aspect of esports is looking to drive its business choices in the right direction with some strong analytics and analysis of their propositions. So without further ado, let's bring Bryce on the show. Thank you so much for joining us on the show. When I've mentioned to those in the office and also in my network that we were hoping to bring you on, everyone had nothing but awesome things to say about you. So just help us understand your story and how you got to where you are today.
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate it. I will try to live up to that hype. it's been an interesting road, to say the least. I mean, when I started trying to work in esports, I had zero connectivity to space. I was just a guy that loved video games, loved watching esports, and also loved watching traditional sports, and really felt like there was an opportunity to kind of combine my passions and hobbies with my career as a lawyer, and hope to kind of put all those things together so that I could wake up every day excited about what I do. And so I started off practicing at the third largest corporate law firm in the city of Seattle, where I had over 150 attorneys, not doing anything related to esports. I was a general commercial litigator. And pretty early on in that job, I started trying to pitch people internally on the concept of esports. And this was back towards the end of 2013. So definitely not as much mainstream exposure as there has been. I would say in general, esports have penetrated mainstream consciousness to the point where, you know, the partners at a general law firm who are in the know on what's going on in the news will have, you know, will cross their desk, right? They would have seen something about sold-out stadiums or millions of dollars in prize money, whatever, but not so much the case in 2013. So did a lot of internal education, simultaneously started trying to think about how to kind of get my foot in the door of the industry. And how I wound up doing that was I authored a white paper, which became a series of white papers, mm-hmm. The first of which was really just kind of a 50,000-foot viewpoint on the future, you know, legal issues in the esports industry vis-a-vis the legal history of traditional sports. You know, what are the things we're going to tackle? We're going to figure out player contracts and player unions. We're going to figure out IP rights and streaming. We're going to figure out collective bargaining, you know, et cetera. And that white paper wound up floating to the top of the League of Legends subreddit. Some folks from within the industry got in touch with me about helping out with their legal work. And at the time, I had practiced for all of, you know, a month or two, right? So I couldn't do the legal work, but there were lawyers at the firm who could. And so we started taking on that work, and I would kind of educate the more senior associates and partners about esports that had relevant backgrounds in sports, media, entertainment, and over time kind of developed my own personal skill sets to actually be able to do that work directly. And before I knew it, the majority of the work that I was doing was work that I was bringing in all in the esports industry. And so it just kind of made sense to make a move and wound up leaving that and co-founding a law firm. And then ultimately about a year and a half ago, I founded ESG Law, which is the world's only dedicated esports law firm. 100% of our book of business is in esports. I have a few attorneys that work with me, a couple of general associates, as well as an immigration attorney who runs our immigration practice. We've got a couple of law clerks, which is just a fancy way of saying interns. So yeah, it's been an interesting path, but a fun one, to say the least.
That's awesome, man. Super, super exciting. I mean, it's always fascinating to hear anyone's story of how they really stepped into the industry, and you've seen it from a brand side, from a third-party service provider aspect as well. Like, it always takes one esports champion to really drive the kind of narrative for understanding the industry and how much potential there is there internally. Echo that from my days of LFG, from building up the world's first esports executive search consultancy. There's a lot of obstacles that you have to overcome, and in terms of a lot of naysayers and those not really seeing the potential of esports or even actually trying to understand it. So well done to you. And
appreciate that. I mean, as it turns out, the people in positions of power pretty much in every industry are also some of the people least likely to be early adopters or engagers with esports content. So it's, you know, I think there are a lot of similar stories kind of basically across every aspect of the industry, right? I mean, the slog of persuading whatever business or service to try to translate whatever it is they're doing to esports, the slog of educating brands that they should be deploying capital in the space, investors, you name it. I mean, it's just, I think we've kind of all been in the trenches, it feels like, for the last 4 or 5 years on that. And now we're at this inflection point where it feels like we've achieved critical mass, and so it's a lot easier to get buy-in than it used to be.
Yeah, it's less what is esports, it's more how can I, you know, enter this market, or have my product actually resonate with this audience, or does this make sense for my brand rather than what is the industry as a whole. The evolution that you just mentioned is an area that I'd really like to hone in on for this episode, specifically for the overall state of the esports legal landscape, but specifically for the players, teams, and just the approach to viewing themselves as a elite professional athlete. From about 2013, when you first stepped into the esports industry, what have been just one or two of the major areas of growth and change that you've seen outside of obviously player salaries, but the complexities of the contracts, had the terms drastically extended? What have been some of the main changes and maturing processes in that area of the market?
Yeah, I mean, the two things that immediately jump out to me are, one, the player contracts themselves, and two, the league infrastructure, the team participation agreements, the rule sets, the charters for the various competitions in which players and teams are competing.
Okay.
So I can tackle those in order. So on the player side, I mean, it's hard to get less advanced than what they were when I started. I mean, I would say the bulk of player contracts at the time were not even written, or if they were, it was not written by a lawyer, kind of a one-page thing, I'll pay you X amount, you'll play on my esports team. And, you know, we've obviously come a long way since then. And even the contracts that were, you know, more akin to an actual contract, they were certainly not custom built for the space, right? They were kind of random independent contractor agreements that someone would try to repurpose, you know, taking something out or adding something in. They failed to cover the bulk of the player team relationship, which is actually a fairly complex and unique relationship. You know, when people ask me, what does the standard esports player contract look like? It, you know, we wrote it from scratch, right? Our player contract is in the hands of thousands of players now around the world. And it was an amalgamation of concepts from traditional sports contracts, concepts from traditional sports collective bargaining agreements, and the type of contract that an independent actor would sign to, you know, sign on to a film. That's really what we're talking about, because the relationships are so much different in many ways than traditional sports, primarily because traditional sports contracts all have these collective bargaining agreements on the side that are making up the bulk of the terms and conditions by which they're performing their services as players. We don't have any of that in esports yet, so we have to do all of that by contract. So by default, our contracts are considerably longer because they have to cover things like what are the rules or obligations around trading or free agency or you name it, right? There's just so much more going on. And then the reason I mentioned the independent actor agreement is because there's a lot of complexity in the promotional obligations between a team and a player and the sponsors of the team and the sponsors of the player potentially that really aren't in play in traditional sports, right? I mean, in traditional sports, all of these rights have kind of been segregated out where you the team is sponsored by Nike, but the player can be sponsored by Under Armour or Adidas, right? These are extremely common structures.
Yeah.
That's far less common in esports, primarily because the way esports grew up were, teams were providing stability to players by giving them flat salaries, and in exchange, they were bundling these rights, the majority of which were not valuable standing alone, right? There's not a huge market for individual player endorsements. There's definitely more than there was in 2013, 2014, 2015. Mm. And so to say nothing of the fact that there wasn't the entire infrastructure on that, right? There weren't a cadre of players, agents, and managers and representatives who could go out and deliver these deals. And so what you did is teams became media companies that were aggregating name, image, likeness rights to players, not just in one game, but several games, bundling them and selling them successfully, far more successfully than the players would have done on their own. So how the industry has evolved led to a situation in which independent sponsorship rights for players are far less common than they are in traditional sports. And I think understandably so, when you kind of think about the economic history and economic and legal history of esports, and the same rights are typically granted. Obviously, the players are paid a heck of a lot more for them now than they used to be, largely because they're more valuable now than they used to be.
I mean, that is ultimately the way that esports will eventually move, right? Like, if you look at how training and like the structure of a pro's day is moving, it's moving slowly towards smarter training rather than just relentless smashing of quick play matches in whichever game you're playing. So one of the things that will help players build their personal brand in a much more consistent way will be actually when they have more time to go back to streaming. So are you expecting the sponsorship market for individual players to kind of smash open? Because sponsorship revenue from the team side is one of the largest areas of a building opportunity, and then if you kind of destabilize that area of the market by having players actually representing competing sports merchandise brands, for example, on broadcast and in all of the content, that could shake the still flourishing foundation of the team infrastructures across the globe.
Yeah, I think we will head in that direction eventually. Mm. I have this conversation with player representatives all the time, some of whom get it, others of whom are a little bit, I think, naive to some of the history that we were just walking through and some of the import of what we were walking through, right? Like, when I get a red line back, and this happens all the time, where like some lawyer that works in the traditional sports space in some capacity will wind up getting connected into an esports deal for some reason, they'll ship me back a red line that kind of takes apart all of the typical IP rights that are granted and said, no, we're not doing that, we're not doing that, we're not doing that. And my reaction to them is always, hey, look, I'm happy to go back to my client and have a conversation about this. And at some point, I think while the industry will have this trajectory, we have to recognize that if you want all of those rights, we're going to cut your offer by 50% or more, right? Because that is a very large part of what is being paid for in the esports ecosystem
100%.
Is those rights, right? So teams, if you look at the P&L of an esports team, anywhere from 40 to 90% of their revenue is coming from sponsorship.
Yep.
If you take away their right to have individual players activate across their sponsors, if you say individual players are in fact going to be promoting or could be promoting competitors of the sponsor of the organization, that's fine. That can work out from a legal perspective. It just fundamentally alters the economics of the player-team relationship. I think we will head in that direction. I think what will ultimately occur, right, is the superstars of the industry, as they get bigger and bigger and there's more demand for individual endorsements, are not going to want to grant these rights to teams. It will have the same consequence it has in other sports ecosystems where net-net, it helps the superstars and hurts the non-superstars, right? Because brands all want to consolidate their spend across the same 1% roughly of pro players, right? They want the most marketable, the best players, et cetera. And so, it's great for that person, but it's not great for the folks that are no longer going to be in a situation where their rights are getting bundled by their organization. And they're going to have to go and try to sell them on their own because, as it turns out, it's going to be pretty hard to sell them.
Sure. And then you alluded that there's been a lot of change on the league side too. From my understanding, all of the franchise leagues have, 100% ownership over most of the player rights with regards to using them in all forms of content, also the team brands. That makes a lot of sense. That's not something you really have to smash your head against the wall for. But mining deeper down into those contracts specifically for the franchise leagues, the strength of control over areas of the market that teams and players can actually activate in is pretty strong. So how have you seen, especially over the last 2 years, this area of the industry actually switch from a legal perspective?
Yeah, I mean, this is an area where we'll kind of paint esports with the broad brush, but the reality is it varies drastically from game to game, right? Like the infrastructure around the, you know, permanent partnership or franchise leagues, we just call them franchise leagues colloquially. It makes things easier, though it's worth noting that from a legal perspective, they're not all formed under franchise law. You know, with that said, the infrastructure, legally speaking, on these franchise leagues is far more complicated and different than is the legal infrastructure around non-franchise leagues, right?
Yeah,
there are massive revenue sharing mechanisms in place. The control, the right that these more permanent partners have vis-a-vis the publisher, or, you know, the owner of the league is just fundamentally different than what it looks like to compete in a different esports league. That being said, these talks have really leveled up across the board. I mean, you know, like the major Counter-Strike leagues, the ESL Pro leagues and ECSs and E-leagues of the world have a better legal infrastructure than any esports league had 3 years ago by far, right? They have charters where everybody's participating in the process. They have some form of revenue sharing mechanisms as well. They're not quite as long and complex in terms of capturing all the different elements of monetization that goes into this. The revenue sharing mechanisms are far less complex, but certainly they are more robust documentation of league operations than what existed in the industry a few years ago.
That's one of the areas that I want to dive into slightly later on is around the kind of player unions and almost like an esports bill of rights per ecosystem. But if we just step away from that for 1 second, one of the areas I kind of want to pick your brain on is if we zoom out of the esports industry for 1 second and we look at, you know, where the value chain is, like in terms of who has the most control over the direction that this industry will take. Are we expecting the kind of IP owners, so the publisher, team, player, ecosystem, like that flow of obviously the publishers having the most power down to the players having the least in comparison to teams? Are we expecting that kind of upside down pyramid to be disrupted in the next few years, and where do you think that kind of change would actually come from, if any?
Yeah, I think that's it's a very fluid power dynamic. Certainly, publishers exercise the most control by virtue of the fact they own the games, and
sure,
there are core legal rights associated with that just don't exist in, you know,
yeah,
baseball, basketball, football,
sure,
right? Like, no one owns a game of basketball. You don't have to pay the Naismith family a royalty to host a basketball tournament or to broadcast it, right? It's a very different dynamic. But that being said, you know, the role teams play in these franchise ecosystems are far more impactful, and it's far more collaborative from a you know, seat at the table perspective than were the ecosystems that existed before them. And I think that by and large, that is a trend for the industry, right? That publishers and league operators are seeing the value of helping teams feel stability within an ecosystem, right?
Yeah.
That they can make longer term investments in infrastructure and development of players, et cetera. And so I think there's a lot of people who kind of see that the value in creating these more permanent structures, which is probably why the industry is by and large trending in that direction, though obviously every ecosystem will always be somewhat different. And I certainly don't ever expect to live in a world in which every major esport falls into that. For example, you know, Valve ecosystems are very unlikely to ever do that because from a business model perspective, they just don't embrace esports in the same way that a Blizzard, Activision, or Riot, you know, does, at least at present. I also would expect, you know, maybe this will send a little into your player union discussion you wanted to have, right? I would expect players to gain more sway in the ecosystems across the board than they have right now. For the most part, players are relatively disorganized. They're not speaking with a formal collective voice, which you can do even if you don't have a formal union, right? Like, so for example, everyone calls the things that are happening out unions. They're really not, right? The LCS Players Association, the CSGO Players Association, neither of them are formal unions. They are really just collective bodies through which players can advocate for their interests, which is really a stepping stone to unionization, but short of unionization in the formal legal sense. I would expect players to think more critically about the business side of their lives. And I'm generalizing. There are tons of players that already are well represented, that think about the business side of their lives, that advocate for themselves in contract and other processes, you know, that are giving input that's being heard behind the scenes on rules development and patches and you name it, right?
Sure.
But across the board, I would say there's a lot of opportunity for growth in that area, right? It's impossible for me to say like what percentage of players are represented across all of esports.
Of course.
It definitely varies wildly by game, right? Like far more players are represented in CSGO and League of Legends and Overwatch than are represented in Rocket League or Smite, right? And it's not to pick on Rocket League or Smite. There's, you know, all different games that have different levels of representation. So look, there's plenty of room for players to seek out more representation, for the quality of that representation to improve and develop their relationships and skill sets, for players to create bodies through which they advocate collectively, for players to create unions that give them the formal legal and economic powers that comes with unions. All of these things will help tip the balance of power more towards players, not saying it from an absolute value perspective, just that they will gain kind of more sway within the broader negotiations that exist throughout esports than they have now.
Yeah, I mean, I've spoken with agents from inside esports, from outside, from music, entertainment, sports, and one of the things that I was quite surprised to hear was that the issues when you start paying young people a lot of money for a very specific skill set is that sometimes they don't always view themselves as a brand. They just look at which number is in bold in terms of how much they're getting paid per year, and they'll go from that. So that's not within esports at all. But one of the things that I've liked seeing over the course of the last 18 months is teams and also more players stepping up to the plate to kind of view themselves as a elite professional athlete that has serious social impact and influence across their fan base and also, you know, the industry as a whole. So this is one of the areas of the industry that I've been very curious about, seeing how it grows over the next few years. We want to have as few stories that you might hear from sports where those that burned the candle at both ends were in a pretty bad spot after they left the ecosystem. I want to see as many pro players go from rookie to pro to leaving the ecosystem in a very healthy and responsible way that really sets them up for success in the future. And that's, you know, one of the things that we try and ingrain into our pros that you might have seen in a previous episode with Hypok from our Optic PUBG team, is the kind of structure that we've tried to put in place. Splice are really outspoken about this, and Astralis as well, is how can we get these players to really be present in the moment, appreciate their time in the spotlight, and do as much as they can to set themselves up, but also help the next generation of pros have an even better experience. Ultimately, esports is a spark in the fireplace, and over the course of the next 20, maybe 30 years, that fire can grow to be roaring if everyone, you know, has their head in the right place. That's just kind of a bit of my insight into what I would love to see from this space. And it's awesome to hear that you're kind of at the forefront of that, not just speaking with teams about how they can improve and how they can manage their expectations, but also being upfront with players, esports personalities, and just those across your roster of clients, just to really help us kind of take these steps forward as an industry.
Yeah, I would echo all of that. And it's not just players, right? It's full-time streamers and broadcast talent. And the reality is the economics around esports are simply going to continue to grow. There will be bumps in the road, I have no doubt, but in 2050, when we're listing the most popular sports in the world, we're going to say soccer and we're going to say a video game. And I don't know what that video game is. It probably doesn't exist yet. Who knows if the platform it's on doesn't exist yet. Probably it doesn't. But the economics around esports are going to get to the scale of global soccer. And it's easy to forget that we are still relatively early days, right? I mean, esports have existed as long as video games have existed, but as independently monetized standalones out of spectator sports were anywhere from 5 to 7 years old, right? If you're not counting Korea. Mm-hmm. And so the dynamics around all of this in the West have a lot of room to grow because they are still so young.
From my side, there has been an esports foundation for many years, but when you started to see the investor interest and the non-endemic brands flowing in at a much higher rate kind of at the start or mid 2016, in a public way at least, you know, that's when esports kind of evolved from, you know, its early age into its adolescence, and it's just a really awesome time to be in the industry, man. It makes me all you know, it makes all of the butterflies in the stomach play out. It's great. One of the other areas of the legal landscape that I would love to get your insight on is looking at how esports players, executives, and talent transcends this global market. I recently went through a very lengthy visa process to be able to work in the US for 3 years. So I can appreciate the hoops that even the business folk have to go through, but if you're looking at...
It sucks, right?
Yeah, it's not easy, but if you're looking at how loose the esports agenda is, how quickly, you know, a certain team might be invited to a certain event halfway around the world, how have you seen, you know, the progress of global authorities actually, you know, acknowledging esports athletes, having the right structures in place to allow for short-term visas or access to countries? How has that landscape played out over the last few years? I assume that there's a massive amount more that we can do, or maybe I'm being too pessimistic there, because even in MMA, which is a much more established sport, you still see quite a few fighters in a yearly period. You know, they will sign up for a fight, and then 3 or 4 weeks before they're supposed to be at the event, they have to back out because of some form of visa problem.
Yeah, look, it's really complicated. It's getting more complicated in the wake of much of the reforms that have come to being under the Trump administration.
Sure, and Brexit.
I can speak to this most most deeply from a U.S. perspective. Globally, it really depends, right? I mean, every jurisdiction is different. In some jurisdictions, it would benefit esports players, talent, you name it, for esports to be formally recognized as sports in the jurisdiction. In others, it doesn't really matter so much. Mm. So it just kind of varies country by country. And obviously, immigration is a deeply political issue. And so depending on where you're from and what country you're trying to get into, it can be easier or harder, right? Not all passports are created equal when it comes to getting into the United States, for example.
Like, are we seeing more of a trend of when you, say, present the case for moving a player from NA to Europe or NA to Brazil or NA to China and then back again? Are we seeing less unnecessary hurdles that you have to overstep in terms of actually fleshing out the written proposition that you have to put down to really get these immigration arrangements open?
Yeah, it depends a lot on what type of visa you're talking about. It was getting easier, right? You know, so many of the esports teams and companies exist in California. And so a lot of the applications for visas, whether they were P1s for players or O1s for talent, you name it, there's so many different visa options depending on who we're talking about. We're going through the same processing unit. And so they were becoming very familiar with esports-based petitions, right? And they became our success rates went way up in the last few years. And so, in general, I assume when I'm applying, when my law firm is helping a team apply for a P1 visa, which is for internationally recognized athletes to help, you know, bring a player into the U.S. to compete in the Overwatch League or the LCS or whatever, I assume we're going to get it, unless they're from a jurisdiction where it's particularly problematic, and even then I think we have a very good shot. It's becoming harder now than it ever was. The hurdles you have to jump through are more complicated. The defaults whereby, for example, if they looked at the petition on its face and they felt like they needed more information. The default used to be that they would request additional evidence. Under a new Trump policy, now the default is towards a denial, which is particularly problematic because RFEs were not that uncommon in the esports space. To say nothing of some of the, you know, types of visas you apply for taking way longer than they used to. You know, there was news made relatively recently that Huhi, the CLG mid laner, got an EB1 visa, basically got a green card, right, which is a really big deal, exciting for him. And it means that he can move to NA residency status as far as the LCS is concerned for their import rules, all which is great. That visa had been started a long time ago, actually, and the SGO associate had worked on that. And the processing timeline for that exact type of visa, which used to be, you know, a year or less, are now pushing 2 years, depending on what country you're coming from. So there are a lot of pain points that are being felt in the esports industry in the wake of some of the immigration reform in the US, to say the least.
No, man, that's kind of what I assume, but that's not very positive. Are there any other areas of the market that you would like to pass comment upon that you're really proud to see a lot of improvement in from a legal side? Like, I feel like player contracts, immigration, and unions are normally those top three that folks would want to learn more about, aside from obviously IP ownership and the intricacies of what that actually looks like. But is there anything else in the market that stands out to you as an area where you've seen a lot of growth or that you'd like to see some improvement?
I mean, look, the reality is there's been growth across the board, right? The dynamics of streaming relationships, endorsement deals, IP ownership, you name it, you know. The industry has really grown up from an infrastructure perspective over the last 5 years. So it's hard for me to name a single area in which our firm operates where I haven't seen meaningful movement from the moment I started working in the industry to now.
Okay. Well, that's a pretty good answer. Bryce, I don't want to keep you for too long for this episode. So thank you very much for spending some time on the show today. Like, your insight has been awesome. We'll close out with our rapid fire round where we just try to understand a little bit more about you as a person. What made you the man you are today, and also how do you kind of approach this ever exciting esports industry? So who has been your biggest mentor, if you've had one, and what was the best piece of advice that you've received?
Yeah, I've been fortunate to have a lot of incredible mentors over the course of my career. I'll pick my most recent, you know, major mentor, which is my boss at Catalyst, Josh Schwartz, who co-founded Wasserman Media Group and has been around sports media entertainment businesses for, you know, literal decades. I think the best piece of advice he ever gave me was that everything in your life can be triaged into one of four buckets. Based on how important it is and how urgent it is. And so you could literally have a grid up on a whiteboard that is, you know, upper left is important and urgent, upper right is important, non-urgent, lower left is urgent, non-important, and then lower right is non-urgent, non-important. And it's amazing how much that can help you triage everything you have to do in your life, from logistical details for, you know, personal stuff, work stuff, family stuff, you name it. But it's amazing because I think probably a lot of people naturally do that and they're deciding what to do. But just having awareness that those are really the four buckets and thinking about what they mean in terms of how you spend each and every minute of your day is, I think, great things that everyone could benefit from.
Yeah, that's awesome. I've been diving into Blinkist recently, which basically just allows you to take awesome snapshots of all kinds of books around thought leadership or just overall interest stories. And one of the few that I've been reading this week, outside of those that aren't related to business at all, have been kind of all focused around how can you free yourself up on an operational perspective, how can you prioritize, how can you be more efficient, but at the same time, how can you better identify the subtle personalities within your team to kind of work out how to speak to, one, your boss, one, your direct reports, to a sponsor, to everyone, because you do speak to everyone in a slightly different tone. So I think that having a higher level ideal like that of, like, how can I just emotionally remove myself from the situation and just put whatever I need to do in a certain area, and then just approach the day like an animal, that's awesome. It's been one of the things that I've been trying to be more cognizant of without having that kind of full bucket approach, but that'll be one thing that I'll be looking up for sure.
good stuff.
Awesome. The next piece is esports has no working hours. We're all on pretty much a 24/7.
Yeah.
What do you do in your personal life or in the day that helps you stay sane and healthy working in esports? Do you have any huge hobbies or passion areas that we might not know about?
Yeah, I mean, I have a wife that helps keep me sane sometimes at the sacrifice of her own sanity. She's an incredible support system through all this.
Yeah.
I mean, I really hate to be that guy, genuinely, but the biggest thing for me was figuring out a diet and exercise routine that really worked. I mean, I got on keto about 18 months ago, and I've never slept better. I've never had more consistent energy throughout the day, and just kind of helping me stay focused. So I was never a morning person before, but I'm now able to wake up really early, clear my email inbox, go work out, then kind of get my full day started. And I'm working more hours than ever before, but I'm doing it in a way that definitely feels a lot less painful, which I think is really the goal. So that's definitely my advice.
That's awesome. Well, like, you've got to treat yourself as a machine, like mind, body, and spirit, right? So that makes a lot of sense. That's been one of the things I've been trying to lean into recently, is removing and experimenting with how eating or drinking certain stuff actually makes you feel.
Yeah, it has a profound impact. It's very, very, very stark. In my experience, most people check the exercise box, but a ton of people that I know don't really think critically about what they're eating. Look, do whatever diet and exercise plan works for you, but I think being conscious about food and how it makes you feel and what does to your energy levels throughout the day is a really important step for people that feel like they're struggling.
Yeah, it's night and day difference if you just have a bit more green in your life, I guess. And the last one before I let you go is, what is your motto that really summarizes your approach just to, you know, being a human on this wonderful planet? What is one of your cornerstones of how you go about your life?
Yeah, I don't know that it ties neatly into some kind of catchy phrase, but I think the thing that I try to focus on always is to start by adding value to someone's life before asking for things. In fact, I never really ask for things. Like, anyone of my clients will tell you, I don't really go out and aggressively clients call up. I'm never the person to bring up the conversation of working together. For me, and this is really kind of how I focus on getting into the industry, right? It's so easy to just go up to people and say, I'm a lawyer, or I'm a financial planner, or I do X, Y, Z thing. You know, I'm a brand salesman, I'm an agent. And I feel like I can help you, right? Like, I can do X, Y, Z for you. The much harder thing is to find a way to prove your value to people, you know, in all contexts of life, before trying to get anything out of it. And so I think that's definitely kind of the thing that's constantly in the back of my mind whenever I'm doing anything. Like, it helps me be a better friend, it helps me be a better husband, it helps me be a better, you know, lawyer and consultant, you name it.
I couldn't put that any better myself. That's a fantastic approach. An eye for an eye makes the whole world blind doesn't really apply, but like, you want to just make everyone better around you by simply being there. It's a more simple form of karma in one way or another, but it's one of the trends that I'm really starting to see from when we ask these questions at the end of the show, is that most people who are leaders in their field leave a room much brighter than it was before they stepped in. And that's one of the most inspiring things about running this and speaking with everyone is learning their lessons, their approaches, and how they've crafted an awesome position for themselves. So, Bryce.
Yeah, for sure. I have to end by saying I'm a little jealous. You get like all of these nuggets of wisdom from all these different cool, influential people from around the space. You must be like the most evolved human ever.
Maybe. No, 100% not. But it's very healthy to be grounded by seeing the progress other people have made, that especially have more experience or more time in this space, or just, you know, time on the planet at all. You know, there's always a lesson that you can learn from everyone that you meet in life. It might be about them, it might be about you, it might be about something wider. So that's one of my favorite things about doing this. But I don't want to hurt the schedule for the rest of your day, so we'll leave it there for now. But Bryce, I really appreciate you just stepping on the show, but also everything that you do in this industry. As I said right at the start, everyone cannot say anything more positive about you, so just thanks, man. Like, we really appreciate it as an industry.
Yeah, well,
I mean, I'm not gonna say that I speak for everyone, but all the work that you do is great. How can everyone reach out to you on socials or by email if you're open to that? What's the best way for everyone to reach out to you?
I'm very easy. There's a, you know, if you want to email me, there's a contact button at the bottom of the ESG Law website. Ditto the Catalyst website. I'm also super active on social. You can find me on Twitter as Esports Law, or LinkedIn is the same thing, or you can just search for my name. I'm all over the interwebs, so I'm very easy to get a hold of if you want to talk to me.
Awesome. All right, man. Well, you have an awesome rest of the day. That's going to do it for this episode of the Esports Roundtable. If you want to reach out to us, it's ES Roundtable Pod on Twitter, Instagram, and all of these other platforms. If you enjoyed this episode, please do leave us a like or a review on iTunes, Spotify, or however you found us today. Have an awesome week, and we'll be back next week.